It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome all of you from all over the world. Today, we're going to talk about spirituality, what role it plays in a patient's recovery from illness, from Huntersfield University in the United Kingdom, how a low DHEA level, which is a prohormone, will cause coronary heart disease, University of Gothenburg. Relax with holy basil, whole new bunch of research on the herb basil, what it does for us. Also, a fatty acid called DHA. I'm sure you've seen it on vitamin bottles. Good news there, decreases by 90%. Brain cell death and inflammation. Meditation and group support linked to cellular benefits for breast cancer survivors. And a lot more on health and nutrition. And natural remedies for urinary tract infections. Also today, taking on the issues that are not addressed by the mainstream or alternative media that I believe are extremely important. For example, we're going to look at a landmark 20-year study that examined over 88,000 farming families and individuals that showed a link between pesticides and depression in farmers, from Modern Farmer. We're also going to take a look at how the Border Patrol became one stunningly corrupt, engorged law enforcement agency. In fact, it's huge. And this goes to my concern about on the corporate left, and I underline corporate left, and the corporate right, they both believe that we could have a better society if only, A, we had the government taking over more chores and becoming even bigger, or B, we take away power from the government and give it to major corporations. Both are wrong. I'll explain why, and I'll give an example by two incidences that I'm going to report on, including the Border Patrol. Also, how college debt is crushing a generation of millennials. John Quealy from Common Dreams. And a longer commentary today that really ties up a lot of what is important in the world. From David Vine, from Tom Dispatch, The Basis of War in the Middle East. Now, I posted a photograph of President Carter on his 90th birthday in a very unassuming way with his work overhauls on and his hammer going into a home down in Texas where a part of Habitat for Humanity who does really good work, he's building a home. I also commend him for the work of standing up for the Palestinian people's right to not be living in an apartheid state, and he took a beating for that. However, I also look at the fact that he opened up the entire door and instigated the largest building of foreign bases, military bases, of any president in American history. And after him came Reagan. It is a cancer that is metastasized. Now, why is this story important? Because when you see the numbers of bases and where they're located and what they do and what it means to the people living in a country to have our military presence and footprint there, then you understand why our entire foreign policy is wrong and has led to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other terrorist organizations and so much dissatisfaction. Plus today, I received some emails that people said, did you see what Jimmy Kimmel did in going out and interviewing people about who were against GMOs, and they were clueless, they didn't know about GMOs. And so I watched it, and indeed, these people seem clueless. But that is not then to mock GMOs. So to Jimmy Kimmel, I'm going to share with you the insights of a young 15-year-old, and it's only 10 minutes long, but if only they had interviewed this person or a million other young people who are very clued in, aware, and know about GMOs. So it's unfair to say that there's no legitimacy to it or that the people are totally clueless. It just depends upon who you speak with. So we'll speak with the right person. Also, for those who never read a box of cereal, they just look at the label. It might say natural on it. It might say wholesome. Might say complete nutrition. We're going to show you what happens when a survey was done and asking people, do you know what's in the cereal you're giving your kids? And then when they don't, would you eat these ingredients now that you know that they're in there? So we have a packed show. If time permits, we'll open it up for your feedback. And by the way, I want to thank all the people on yesterday's program who called in. Now, it's a little bit confusing. Let me explain it. Yesterday, our sister station in New York City, WBAI, had a program on a one-hour special from our Progressive Commentary Hour, which I do live on Tuesday evenings, on a reexamination of Rwanda. And it challenges everything and everyone involved in Rwanda, the massacre, and by people who really know their stuff. And but at the same time, I was doing a live broadcast from the Progressive Radio Network all over the world. And because I was in a cab last night, and someone says, which show were you on? I said, well, one day a week I do two. One's pre-recorded, the other's live. And next week, just for our WBAI audience, 2 days, all programming from 9 a.m. until evening are preempted for the Pacifica Archive fundraising, which is a good thing and important. But I will still be doing my show live, which you can listen to over the telephone, by calling this number. Write it down now, 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. But sometimes there's so many people listening, it's busy, so you'll call a separate number, 401-347-0456, 401-347-0456, or you can listen over ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. That's Wednesday and Thursday of next week on just one of the many stations that carry the show to WBAI. Now to the issue. This is from Huddersfield University, United Kingdom. Let me quote exactly. It says, the university leads research and teaching into spirituality, into healthcare, to give people hope and meaning and purpose. The term spirituality is now widely used to describe the qualities that give people hope. In the case of patients, it can aid their recovery. The university has become a key center for research into spirituality and how it can be integrated into healthcare teachings and practice. Articles, overseas conference presentations, now close links with the National Health Society, trusts are among the recent outposts and activities. And it goes on to talk about what actually happens. And here's what one of the research scientists there said. This is a senior professor, advanced nurse practitioner at the university, one of the leaders of the special interest group, with a professor, John Wattis. They admit that many people regard spirituality as a nebulous term or one that is often conflated with religion. However, spirituality is, in quote, intensely practical. It helps to sustain healthcare workers and patients by recognizing and supporting a sense of meaning and purpose in life. It can improve resilience in patients and practitioners alike, in addition to improving the experience of illness and crisis in patients. Okay, what does this mean in just regular sense? Well, let's go back to the early part of the 19th century in the United States. In the southern part of the United States, where I come from, there is a practice that is extremely common, was at that time, is not today. And it was where the doctor would give you the best that he knew or she knew of medicine, but also important would be to sit with you and either pray or hold your hand and give encouraging input. It was called Christian medicine. Now, it's probably not known outside of that area of the country and probably not known by any of the millennial or X generation today, but it's very common. And when I spoke with my family physician who did that when I was growing up, and I asked, why do you do it? He said, because there is something beyond medicine that causes the person to heal when they shouldn't, and we couldn't. And later, I would see that firsthand. And I'm a big believer in what is called the exchange of energy. Everything we do every day is an exchange of energy. Example, if I choose to have bacon and eggs instead of a health smoothie, that's an exchange of energy. I'm exchanging something that is going to be negative in its consequences. Not just negative in what it does to my body, to my digestive system, to my blood chemistry, to the cells, but also I'm reinforcing a negative pattern. I'm making a choice that is ultimately going to be destructive. Just don't know when. On the other hand, if I choose, by conscious awareness, the importance of feeding my body what it needs, what is in alignment and harmonizing with it, then that harmonizing of positive intent with positive energy and positive performance then creates a positive harmony. And hence there is a blissful moment where you're actually able to empower your dopamine, your positive energy, and positive energy in and of itself creates bliss. So you're kind of living a more blissful life by the positive choices you make. Now, of course, standing between a positive choice and negative choice is information, wrong information, right information, and do we really want to know the right information if it makes us uncomfortable or if it challenges much of our underlying beliefs? Because at the end of the day, and I'll make this statement again, it is not dementia or Alzheimer's that's going to cause your mom or dad to go into that dark place. It is not cancer, heart disease, or diabetes that will ultimately take your loved one. It is not the loss of money or a job that ultimately leads to bankruptcy. Even something more systemic in our society. The loss of your freedoms, whether you've experienced that loss or not, whether you've been stopped and searched, whether you have been beaten, tasered, shot at, whether you've been falsely accused or arrested, whether you've had asset forfeiture, whether your phones have been tapped, your emails downloaded, all that is due less a source of the government and the intelligence agency than your belief system. Because if your belief system says that any price is worth paying to maintain security, then you will not look at the loss of any of your freedoms as meaningful. So all of our problems in the world today are due based upon our belief systems. And that's the one thing we absolutely as a society refuse to address. There's no conversations on it at all. To the contrary, if you want to get someone really angry and rageful, challenge their belief systems and see the reaction. So when you are living in alignment with that which is naturally aligned with universal principles of cause and effect, then every action has a consequence. There is no such thing as a single, not one single thought in your life that does not have a consequence. Every breath you take has a consequence. Every second there is a consequence. You're just unaware of most, which is understandable. Because 95 to 99% of everything we do every day resides in our subconscious. Hence, that is purely reactive and never reflective, always reactive. Here's how it works. When you're conscious in this moment, when you choose to stay conscious and positive, you are not reacting, you're reasoning. Hence, you're reflective. When you're allowing yourself to react, no matter how self-righteous your argument, then you are coming purely from conditioned response. There will never be a good outcome to that because you're not in alignment, you're not going to harmonize. It's like the person says, I'm nervous, I got to take a tranquilizer. I'm anxious, I got to take an antipsychotic medication. I can't sit still, I better smoke a cigarette. You know, I'm not focused, I better drink coffee. All of those choices in that moment may provide a palliative. None of them are in alignment with conscious, positive cause and effect outcomes. You will regret all of those in time. But therein lies hubris, arrogance, and an enormously formidable defense to our belief systems. So that said, all the more reason that when I sit across from a person who has a letter from their doctor saying there's nothing more we can do with this person, we've tried everything, and we've given up, just like the man who is the co-creator of The Simpsons has given up, given his money to a charity. And so I put up on the internet, would someone reach out to this man, let him know that he hasn't tried everything. He has not sat across some people 5 years after their due death date and are alive and well. We have 100 people he could speak with who might give him some encouragement. Will he call those people? Will he even want to? If he's already gone through the ritualization of his death, then he cannot, by any measure currently available to the average person, reverse it. You must honor the death of orthodoxy, or your orthodox approach to death. It would be tantamount to challenging your belief system to say, I want to try something else. Because everyone around you, from your family, they're equally guilty, but they're not going to be in the coffin with you. They should be. Now, that would be a, let's see if they give you a different opinion. Should we try something else? No. But I've tried everything and it doesn't work. Too bad. Don't get involved in quackery. But if everything we've tried doesn't work, isn't that quackery? Because we paid hundreds of thousands of dollars and we were given assurances based upon good science. And then we trusted that. And then when I got the science, there was no science justifying it. So isn't that quackery? We have to deny that. So you're denying a truth? We always deny truth. That's the whole basis of every belief system. Perpetually deny all truths. So, now you start to understand a little bit of what it means to work with people who are terminally ill. You have to start with hope. You have to start with faith. You have to start with having something to live for more than your belief system. Because your belief system has got you where you're dying. Do you understand that? It's got you bankrupt. It's got you divorced. It's got you abused. It's gotten you neglected. It's gotten you to adapt to lies and deceit till one day you don't know the truth from anything. That's your belief system. That is 100% of the problem in America, and we will not give 1% credit for 100% of the problem. That's how warped our perceptions are. Wow. You want to help someone live? You better get them into the right side of the light, because the dark side, no, it doesn't work. Next up, we rarely test our hormones. We should. There's one hormone everyone should test, and it's called DHEA. It is a pro-hormone, and this is from the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Quote, men with low levels of DHEA in the blood run an increased risk of developing coronary heart disease. And that was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. The term pro-hormone, by the way, refers to the precursor of a hormone, DHEA, and it is produced by the adrenal glands. It can be converted to active sex hormones, and while the tendency of DHEA levels fall with age, we've known that for a long time. What we have not known is that it puts you at greater risk of heart disease. Now we do. So make sure you get checked for your DHEA. It doesn't take a lot, 20, 25 milligrams. That's not a lot. Relax with holy basil. Now, anxiety, it is endemic in our society. Roughly 18% of Americans have anxiety. And it really affects your life, your health, your relationships, your work. So now we find out that this ancient ancient herb, holy basil, which is not the same as sweet basil, by the way. The popular herb used in Italian dishes, that's not it. This is holy basil. There's a lot of research showing it is strongly anti-inflammatory, anti-ulcer, anti-cancer, anti-diabetic, anti-convulsive. It is extremely versatile as an herb. It also falls into the category, like ginseng, of an adaptogenic herb. And herbs also like rhodiola and ashwagandha are adaptogenic, meaning it helps the body adjust to internal external stresses. But this one also helps you with mood. It enhances mood at 500 milligrams twice a day after meals. There was a good study on this and showed against a placebo it had substantial improvements, helping sleep, exhaustion, sexual problems, forgetfulness. Yeah, all those. So try that. Now there's a fatty acid. It's called DHA. And according to Loyola University researchers in Chicago, it really is good for your brain cells, keeps them from dying, and it turns off inflammation. That could help people with dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, multiple sclerosis. Research has found that it is a primary inflammation that causes brain cells to die. There are other factors, but that's the primary reason. And so using DHA, quote, researchers observed 90% less inflammation and death in brain cells exposed to DHA. From Dr. Michael Collins, quote, fish oil has the potential of helping preserve brain integrity in chronic alcohol abusers. We don't want people to think it's okay to take a few fish oil capsules and then continue to going out and abusing alcohol. The results with corresponding models support involvement of the neuroinflammatory peroxidative pathways and the neurodamage with potential regulation. And then it says how DHA emerged as a strong neuroanti-inflammatory, meaning in lay language, it protects your brain cells from dying, turns off inflammation. That's really good news, and people should be using that, and has enormous benefit. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come back. We have a lot more, including, well, before we go to the break, let me just share some remedies for urinary tract infections, which, by the way, affect millions of Americans every day. The most important of these, which can really cause some adverse, from really bad smelling urine to pain in the pelvic area, to a burning sensation, even high temperatures. One of the best things you can do is called bromelain. Brome, B-R-O-M-E-L-A-I-N, bromelain. That's an enzyme. And if you look at the center of a pineapple, that's where the most bromelain is. And that is strongly anti-inflammatory. And if you take that core and you pulverize it and put it into a smoothie and then put a teaspoon of probiotics in and to put about 3,000 milligrams of buffered vitamin C at the same time. And by the way, it is one of the best things in the world for your urinary tract infection. And then put some organic, unfiltered apple cider vinegar. It is phenomenal for killing bacteria in the urinary tract. And then 10 drops of wild oregano oil. All right? Makes a big difference. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Give it all up for another guy. Baby, I'm telling you, don't let you got the love that I really need. Cause if you leave me this way, baby, you know what? I may not live to see a brand new day.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. We have a very important commentary about how we've gotten into the mess we're in. Without the context and the historical perspective, then nothing being said in the media today makes any sense. But once you understand the problem and how we evolved it, then you understand what we have to do. First off, I'm calling now for activists in this audience. I'm calling for two types of activists: college professors, adjuncts, tenured, and students. Start the process of a major national campaign to forgive college debt and interest on the debt. Start with the interest on the debt. Then to change the bankruptcy law so you can get out of that debt. I believe that with as many college students as concerned as they are, with 70% of college graduates facing enormous loans when they get out and only 55% of college graduates able to get any kind of job, and the majority of those are not in the field of their study, and they're minimum wage jobs. All these jobs reports are all fraudulent because they don't show you that the majority of the people are frequently at low-end jobs. And since you, or in most cases, your parents or even grandparents had to sign on as a guarantor of that loan, they're now being challenged. In fact, senior citizens owe over $8 billion. And that means that with their limited incomes of Social Security, pensions, they're in a big mess. And the way the law works, they can garnish up to 25% of anyone's wages that is owes a debt, but they can empty out your bank account completely. So let's just say that you get a Social Security check of $1,000. The credit company that you owe the money to can take 100% of it. So you'd be left with nothing, because emptying out your bank account for your debt is not covered by federal law, and that's by intent. That's the power of the banking lobby. So we're living in a nation crushed by debt. So it's time for the students to stand up, join together, write articles showing the extreme punitive nature, and also the fact that in some of the states where you have the most students and the most student debt, you now have the return of debtors' prisons. You can go to jail. You can end up in a debt servitude where you never get out of it. Why? Because let's say that you can't pay a debt, any debt. It could be a parking ticket. If you don't pay it, or you can't pay it, then your debt is privatized. And then a private organization with its own constables that can arrest you, its own private prison system, its own privately appointed probation officers that charge you every time they counsel you. And if you can't pay for being in jail because you're already so poor you couldn't pay the original debt, then your initial, let's say, $100 debt can become $5,000. You'll never get out of it. And they can take you back to jail anytime they want, because the moment they take you back to jail for not paying an earlier debt, you start being charged every single day for being in that private jail. And then when you get out of jail, you have to see a probation officer, and then you have to pay the probation officer. And then you have to pay the court for arresting you. That's what we become. Democrat, Republican, the President of the United States, they're all in on this. They're all aware of it. So you have to ask, at what point do you fight back? Well, the people who are most likely to fight back are the students. Let's see if they will. Thus far, there's been no movement whatsoever in the United States with millions of students to address this issue. I think it's time. unless they want, you know, to continue living in this debt peonage society. But that means then they are not appreciating the consequences to their future and their happiness. Now, a couple of program announcements. Not this Sunday, but a Sunday week from now, November 23rd, I'm going to be holding a homesteading meeting for those people who would like to begin a homesteading project starting in January, February, March. You'll call 646-926-5422 if you want to come to that. Also, tonight at 5 o'clock, I'm going to be doing a conference call with people who would like to join together around the world. You can be anywhere in the world and do that as long as you have access to a computer, where we're going to start putting up the crimes of. It's a whole new part of a program to identify those corporations, individuals within those corporations, and what they do that are crimes against humanity. Whether or not they're legal or illegal is irrelevant. It's there if they're immoral, because remember, you can't say something that is legal is okay because they've manipulated the legal system to create laws that protect them. So let's just say, for example, the crimes of Big Agra, the crimes of big energy, like the nuclear industry, the oil, gas, hydrofracking, whatever it may be, then one person would take on a project, a single project, and do the research on, let's say, the crimes of Wall Street, looking at all the crimes of one institution on Wall Street, like Bank America, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Chase. And then we're going to collect all this information and put it together and release it in a series of reports, one a week for a year, so that anyone who is naive enough to think that any major institution has our interests at stake, we will have the facts, the documents showing these are criminal organizations, all of them. So if you want to be a part of that, you'll call Jeremy at 646-926-5434, 646-926-5434. That conference calls today at 5. Also, we're trying to make sure that the premiums for one of our sister stations, and it's the only place we ever have this problem, BAI, gets out in a reasonable period of time. We have agreed to pick, pack, and ship them to expedite this. Our hope is that the station will follow up when it's in, but if we could have a couple volunteers, because the day that they say yes, we'll get them all out, and that's important. So you can call 646-926-5422 if you'd like to help come in and do that. We're just trying to expedite that. Let's take a moment and offer up to Jimmy Kimmel and the audience who saw the person on the street interviewed about not knowing anything about genetically modified organisms. He didn't speak with Rachel Parent, 15-year-old. Here's what she would have answered concerning her knowledge of GMOs and their danger.
Imagine, you just got home from school or work, and you're starving. It's too early for dinner, so you grab a bag of corn chips and start munching. As you reach into the bag to grab another chip, you notice something on the package label. New and improved, now made with genetically engineered corn. Your first thought is, wow, science is awesome. This corn must have more nutrients, or maybe it can be grown with less water or something equally as cool, right? If only that was true. What if I told you that this corn was not engineered to taste better, or to give you more nutrients, or to be grown with less water, or to grow faster? But instead, was engineered to have its own internal insecticide. You know, a chemical that would rupture the stomachs of bugs when they tried to eat the corn. Sound like a tasty after-school snack to you? But don't worry. You may never see this kind of information on your packages of corn chips. Because although this insecticide corn is being used in more than 70% of the processed food on our shelves, the companies who engineered it are spending millions of dollars to make sure it's never put on the label. Wouldn't you like to see this kind of information on your food labels? I would. My name is Rachel Parent. I'm 15 years old. And I've been creating awareness about GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, since I was 12. So, if we've been eating GMOs for the last 20 years, what's the big deal? Many scientists say that GMOs are nothing to worry about. I'm not a scientist. But somehow the idea of eating food that contains its own bug killer sounds a bit strange to me. So I decided to learn all I could about these GMOs. Here's what I found. When first created, GMOs were supposed to increase yields, be better for the environment, give us more nutrition, and use less water. Sadly, after 2 decades, this wish has not come true. Corn, canola, soy, and sugar beets. The 4 GM crops that dominate our fields and our food do one of 2 things. Create its own internal insecticide, or remain alive after being repeatedly sprayed with pesticides. So, what else has happened in these same 20 years? Global agriculture has made a huge shift. Industrialized farming, monocropping, plants hardwired with pesticides, chemical companies that own seeds, and the lawsuits to defend those patented seeds when they get blown into a neighbor's field. Slowly, I began finding studies that disagreed with the GMOs are awesome studies. Scientists around the world were asking questions and sometimes losing their jobs for asking those questions. It was easy to get confused, though. I mean, which scientist should I believe? Which study was more accurate? Fortunately, it didn't take a scientist to figure things out. Even a 15-year-old can research enough to realize when a corporation pays for or coordinates a study and hires a third party to keep them from looking biased. The more I learned about GMOs, the more I began to wonder about their purpose. And the more I found out about their purpose, the more I began to worry about my future and the future of the planet. So, what is the purpose of genetic engineering? The argument you hear most often is to feed the world. The world already produces more than enough food. The real reason for hunger is poverty, as any global hunger or poverty organization around the world will tell you. When corporations control food, the cost of food goes up, making poverty worse. Another argument you might hear is that GMO crops increase yields. Many studies have proven that GMO crop yields are no better than conventional crops. So, if they aren't increasing yields, and they aren't feeding the world, what are they doing? They are dramatically increasing pesticide use. If you engineer a crop to withstand weed killer, you use weed killer more often because you're not afraid of hurting the crop. If you use weed killer more often, weeds evolve to resist it. But don't worry, the corporations have the answer to super weeds too. They are now engineering corn and soybean to be resistant to 2,4-D. You know, the key ingredient in Agent Orange to kill those huge evolved weeds. Corn chips, anyone? Beneficial insects are being harmed. Monarch butterflies need milkweed. But milkweed is almost gone thanks to all those weed killers. This year, the monarch population is at its lowest point in history. A 90% decline. And the same thing is happening with bees and pesticides all around the world. Other crops are being contaminated too. Seeds are spread by wind, water, bees, and birds. So what happens when these genetically engineered seeds start growing in the field next door? The organic crop gets contaminated Meanwhile, the organic farmer is held liable to fix the problem. Or worse, face a lawsuit for having illegally grown patented seeds in their field. That'd be like you being sued by your neighbor if he spray painted his house purple and some of it blew onto your house. Crazy, right? Nearly two decades after GMOs have been introduced into our diet, no long-term human health studies have been conducted. Although many animal feeding studies have been done. A study published by the journal showed that GMOs were actually decreasing yields. Another study showed that GMOs were actually related to allergies. This study was done by the Journal of Pediatrics. They showed food allergies in 1 in 12 children. Is there a connection? Dr. Thierry Vrain, a retired research scientist from Agriculture Canada, speculate that by inserting a foreign gene into the plant, it may be creating a new allergic response. As of today, 64 countries around the world already require mandatory GMO labeling, including the entire European Union, where they outright ban them. Canada and the U.S. are the only two industrialized nations in the world that don't require mandatory GMO labeling. A couple of years ago, I was honored to meet with Dr. Sarah Leaney, a professor from the University of Caen, who conducted a two-year feeding study on rats. The results were sobering. Organ damage, digestive disorders, immune system problems, tumors, even premature death. Other studies resulted in stillbirths and reproductive problems. I was only 11 years old when I first heard...
And that was Rachel Parent, a 15-year-old. If only she had been interviewed. A landmark 20-year study finds pesticide linked to depression in farmers from Dan Noschwitz of Modern Farmer. It's causing clinical depression, but the governments are not stepping in to do anything. In fact, earlier this fall, researchers from the National Institutes of Health finished up a landmark 20-year study. They spoke with 84,000 farmers, and they did it over a period of time, and they found a connection between pesticides and depression, a connection that showed that the evidence was far more pervasive than what anyone had ever thought. And quote, this is from Dr. Frieda Kamel, lead researcher on the study. There have been scattered reports in the literature that pesticides were associated with depression. We wanted to do a new study because we had more detailed data than most people have access to. The excessive amount of this data includes tens of thousands of farmers with specific information about which pesticides they are using and whether they had sought treatment for a variety of health problems, from pesticide poisoning to depression. Farmers were surveyed multiple times through the 20-year period, which gives the researchers an insight into their health over time that no other study has. And then it goes on to talk about how excessive this data is, and found that the malathion and other pesticides used by tens of thousands of farmers, which was banned in Europe, by the way, for what it's worth, contributed to the depression. So there we have it. Tens of thousands of American farmers poisoned, nothing done about it. With the launch of a new U.S.-led war in Iraq and Syria against the Islamic State, the United States has engaged in aggressive military action in at least 13 countries in the greater Middle East since 1980. As I mentioned earlier in the program, every American president has evaded, occupied, bombed, or gone to war in at least one country in the region, all beginning with Jimmy Carter. The total number of invasions, occupations, bombing operations, drone assassination campaigns, and cruise missile attacks runs into the dozens. As in prior military operations in the greater Middle East, U.S. forces fighting ISIS have been aided by access to and the use of an unprecedented collection of military bases. The Occupy region, sitting atop the world's largest concentration of oil and natural gas reserves, and has long been considered the most geopolitically important place on the planet. Indeed, since 1980, the U.S. military has gradually garrisoned the greater Middle East in a fashion only rivaled by the Cold War garrisoning of Western Europe, or in terms of concentration by the bases built to wage past wars in Korea and Vietnam. In the Persian Gulf alone, the U.S. has major bases in every single country except one, Iran. There's an increasingly important, increasingly large base in Djibouti, just across from the Red Sea, from the Arabian Peninsula. There are bases in Pakistan on one end of the region and in the Balkans on the other. They're in the Indian Ocean in the Diego Garcia Islands. In Afghanistan and Iraq, there was once as many as 800 bases in Afghanistan, 505 bases in Iraq. Recently, Obama signed an agreement with the new Afghan president, Ghani, to maintain 10,000 American troops and at least 9 major bases in the country beyond the official end of combat. In short, there is almost no way to overemphasize how thoroughly the U.S. military now covers the region with bases and troops, and this infrastructure of war has been in place for so long and is taken for granted by the American public that we never talk about it, and we should. Members of Congress spend billions and billions of dollars every year on base maintenance, new construction, but ask no questions about where the money's going and the privatization of all this. Here's the latest estimate. Consider this amount. We have spent $10 trillion protecting the Persian Gulf oil supplies over the past 40 years. Approaching its 35th anniversary, the strategy of maintaining such a structure of garrisons, troops, planes, and ships in the Middle East has been one of the great disasters of history of our American foreign policy. The rapid disappearance of debate about our newest possible illegal war should remind us of just how easy this huge infrastructure basis has made it for anyone in the Oval Office to launch a war that seems guaranteed, like its predecessors, to set off a new cycle of blowback and even more war and more terrorists. On their own, the existence of these bases has helped generate radicalism and anti-American sentiment. As was famously the case with Osama bin Laden and the U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, the bases have fueled militancy as well as attacks on the United States and its citizens. They have cost us hundreds of billions of dollars, even though they are not, in fact, necessary to ensure the free flow of oil globally. They have diverted tax dollars from the complete alternative energy sources that we could have in place and should have long ago, including geothermal, wave, solar. They could have met all of our domestic needs. We could have de-ghettoized every city in the United States and created enough positive jobs at a living wage to put all Americans who chose to be back at work. Instead, we choose to control the world like colonial rulers and autocrats that we have always been. After 35 years of base building in the region, it's long past time to look carefully at the effects of Washington's garrisoning of the Middle East. Why? It's simple. It comes down to three words and nothing more. Vast oil reserves. While the Middle East base buildup began in earnest in 1980, Washington long attempted to use military force to control this swath of resource-rich Eurasia and, with it, the global economy. Since World War II, as the late Chalmers Johnson, an expert on U.S. basing strategy, explained it back in 2004, he said, quote, "The United States has been acquiring permanent military enclaves whose sole purpose appears to be the domination of one of the most strategic important areas of the world." After 1945, after Germany's defeat, the Secretaries of War, State, and Navy tellingly pushed for the completion of a partially built base in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia. Despite the military's determination that it was important to do it, yet it was unnecessary for the war against Japan. But that's what they wanted. Going clear back to 1949, the Pentagon had established a small permanent Middle East naval force in Bahrain. In the early 1960s, President John F. Kennedy began the first buildup of naval forces in the Indian Ocean just off the Persian Gulf. Within a decade, the Navy had created the foundations for what would become the first major U.S. base in the region on the British-controlled island of Diego Garcia. In these early Cold War years, though, Washington generally sought to increase its influence in the Middle East by backing and arming regional powers like the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Iran under the Shah, and Israel. However, within months of the Soviet Union's 1979 invasion of Afghanistan and Iran's 1979 revolution overthrowing the Shah, this relatively hands-off approach was no longer the issue. In January of 1980, President Jimmy Carter announced a fateful transformation of U.S. policy. It would become known as the Carter Doctrine. In his State of the Union address, he warned of the potential loss of regional efforts containing, quote, more than two-thirds of the world's exportable oil, now threatened by Soviet troops, which was not true. And he said, we were going to be there because otherwise the Soviet Union's pose a grave threat to free movement of the Middle East oil. Carter warned that, quote, an attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States of America. Such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force, end quote. So with those words, Jimmy Carter, on one side of his character, a noble and conscientious man, made one of the worst calculated political decisions of any president in history. Jimmy Carter must be held responsible for launching one of the greatest base construction efforts in history. He and his successor, Ronald Reagan, presided over the expansion of bases in Egypt, Oman, Saudi Arabia, and other countries in the region to host what was called a rapid deployment force, which was to stand permanent guard over the Middle East petroleum supplies. Their air and naval base in Diego Garcia, in particular, was expanded at a quicker rate than any base since the war in Vietnam. By 1986, more than $500 million was invested in just that one alone. Then it became billions, then hundreds of billions. Now it exceeds $1 trillion. Soon enough, that rapid deployment force grew to the U.S. Central Command, which had overseen three wars, the first Iraq War, the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and intervention in Lebanon. How'd that happen? How did that work out for you? 1982-84, a series of smaller-scale attacks in Libya, 1981, 86, 89, 2004. How'd that go? How's Libya today? A beacon of democracy? Beautiful city on the ocean? Don't think so. Afghanistan, 1998. Sudan, 1998. And the tanker war with Iran, 1987-88, which led to the accidental downing of an Iranian civilian airliner, killing 290 passengers. Why is that never talked about on Fox? I forgot. They're Iranians. They don't count. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan during the 1980s, the CIA helped fund and orchestrate a major covert war against the Soviet Union by backing Osama bin Laden. Yeah, then he was our ally. And other extremist Mujahideen. The command was also playing a role in the drone war in Yemen in 2002, secretly, and in Somalia, 1992, 1994, 2001. And during and after the first Gulf War in 1991, the Pentagon dramatically expanded its presence in the region. Hundreds of thousands of troops were deployed to Saudi Arabia in preparation for the war against Iraq. Yep. And the invasion in Afghanistan 2001 and Iraq 2003 and the subsequent occupation of both countries led to a more dramatic expansion of bases. How many? At the height of the wars, there was 1,000-plus U.S. checkpoints, outposts, and major bases in the two countries alone. The military also built new bases in Uzbekistan and other countries. And Tajikistan and Kazakhstan. Yep, we're everywhere in Central Asia. It's the infrastructure war. It is permanent. It is pernicious. It is privatized. It is just too profitable to stop. We've created a metastasizing cancer. It is bleeding the American treasury, but not a single voice from Bernie Sanders, from, oh, who's that really hip and positive, progressive, out of the Northeast, what's her name, a Warren? Yeah. Hillary Clinton with a better temperament. Nothing more, nothing less. But don't take my word for it. Look at what she's voted for. Ah, facts. So if you want to know why we have more terrorists now than ever before, and why we will never win a war on terror, why don't you take a look at what we've done to the countries and our footprint? And we're there to bring democracy? No. Freedom? No. To end suppression? If we did, then why didn't we do it in Saudi Arabia? Or Bahrain? No, we're there for those three words and nothing else. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more in our next program. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I've gotten a bunch of emails about, they found out the cause of Robin Williams' death. Of course, we know that he hung himself from suicide, but they looked deeper with the autopsy, and they found that he had what's called Lewy body dementia. And basically, this happens because of protein deposits, and they're correlated with the beta amyloid plaque buildup and what we call tangles in the brain, so that the neurons can't fire back and forth correctly, and it affects, of course, your personality. And I thought I'd mention this because, you know, so many times you've spoken about the dangers of a lifestyle that creates beta amyloid plaque in the brain, as well as other deteriorations in our body. I thought you might want to comment on this.
What the world has not acknowledged and will refuse to is that Robin Williams was also taking antidepressant medication, and one of the side effects is suicide. But then again, virtually every shooter has been on antipsychotic or antidepressant medications. They refuse to acknowledge this, everyone. And these were people who were normal in their behavior prior to that. Now to the larger issue. I've counseled thousands of celebrities, not only in my New York office, but for over 30 years when I had a close friend who was a major player in Hollywood, a major producer, financier of films. So a lot of activity went on in his home. And he would ask me all the time, could you counsel this person, that person? So I counseled them just to see if it would make a difference. In all of the cases of all these celebrities, there's certain underlying things that I find. One is deep insecurity. Two, a detachment from the reality of being responsible for themselves on a day-to-day level. Three, a commitment. There are some exceptions, by the way. There are certainly some exceptions of commitment to making a better world for other people, not just themselves. But for the vast majority, the entire environment seduces you. It gives you the sense that you are unique and special. You are loved and appreciated. And therefore, you don't pick up the check. You don't pay for the drugs, but they're everywhere. You get to go to the selective places where every fetish and every fantasy you have will be fulfilled by wonderful people who are there just to service you. There's always a red carpet. If you go into a full restaurant, they'll take someone away from a table to give it to you. And not once will you think, why should those people have to leave the table for me? We're both here to eat a meal. Why should I need a red carpet? Why should I need this? But a person becomes altered, but is already a sense of insecurity and a desire to overcompensate by succeeding to prove to their parents or prove to whoever didn't love them enough as a child or dysfunction or abuse that they've made it. See? If you only knew back then that I would be so successful or loved or beautiful or handsome today, then you would have treated me differently. But it doesn't compensate. And then one day the person is doing things that clearly are destroying them and speeding up the aging of their body, the drugs, the alcohol, He did massive amounts of both, as did John Belushi and the people he hung with. I know a lot of secrets. I know a lot of things people I'm counseling tell me about other people who are equally famous, who are friends of theirs, and what they've done together. I don't betray those secrets because I tell them whatever they tell me will stay with me, and it has. I've never betrayed a secret. But I can tell you, they flock together. You won't find a Robin Williams hanging with someone who's living a really spiritual existence. And I'm not talking about the phony, stupid California spiritual nonsense. You know, like the people who will drink their wheatgrass in the morning, get a colonic in the afternoon, and then shoot heroin at night. And that's typical. I'm talking about really together people. So then one day you wake up and you find out that it's payback time. You're going to be paying your karma in this life at this time. A heart attack, cancer, dementia, at what should be an age when you should be enjoying the fruits of your life. But you never grew up and you never were responsible enough to take control of your own life because you couldn't take it away from all the yes people who are there. But now that you're sick and now that you've got problems, all those yes people, all those facilitators are gone. And you're there in your lonely moment. But you've really been alone all along. You just haven't paid attention. No matter how many people surround themselves when you're on your way up, none of those people are going to be there on your way down. Hope that answers the question.
Sure does. And by the way, Gary, it's official. Russia has banned all GMOs.
One more reason to nuke them. Let Mr. Boner, keep forgetting his right name, bring that up. That'd be a good reason, I think. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. It's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, and listeners have their say.
Well, if this was California, their minds are already free. That's a problem. They got to go find them, bring them back. Where'd my mind go? Where's my mind? Utrice Lead right now.